Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With Russian political tourists occupying government buildings in eastern Ukraine, we will begin with Russia warning Ukraine of civil war if it uses force to quell the protests it is provoking, and the US and NATO warning Russia to stay out of Ukraine. Alexander Motyl, a professor of political science at Rutgers University, who is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and author of The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929, joins us to discuss his latest article in the Kiev Post, Could Russia Occupy Ukraine? And this increasingly volatile situation that could quickly get out of hand and lead to serious bloodshed between Russia and Ukraine and a confrontation between the West and Putin's Russia. Then we will speak with Josh Ruxin, the director of health builders in Rwanda, who has led projects in several developing countries operating at the intersection of public health, business, and international development. He lives with his family in his adopted home of Rwanda, where his wife runs a successful restaurant, and is the author of A Thousand Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda. We will discuss the commemoration this week in Rwanda of the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide and the extent to which the country has revived and the people have healed from the almost incomprehensible massacres of over 800,000 mostly ethnic Tutsis at the hands of Hutu extremists, many of whom killed former neighbors, friends, spouses, and children. And joining us now is Alexander Motyl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, and he's a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory, and the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. His latest article at the Kiev Post is Could Russia Occupy Ukraine? Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motyl.
Thank you for having me.
And it looks as though, I mean, we have a strange situation now where Russia is warning about civil war in Ukraine and NATO is warning Russia not to invade Ukraine. And you've taken it further, I guess, by questioning whether Russia could occupy Ukraine. But at this point, it would seem to be what Putin's strategy is, and it's not exactly original. It's pretty much from the playbook from Crimea, is to destabilize it, to put in these political tourists to cause trouble and to create enough ferment that then they can call for a referendum. So at this point, it looks more like he wants to carve off this territory rather than take over the entire country. So obviously, you're concerned he'll go further.
Well, I'm having done some of those calculations to which you referred in that article, I'm a little less concerned that he'd go further, because having looked at some of these U.S. Army studies on how many troops one would need in order to occupy a country that's experiencing insurgency, I realized that Russia would have to deploy virtually its entire armed forces, more than 750,000 troops, in order to occupy Ukraine. And that is not inconceivable, but it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. This would obviously mean transforming Russia into a war state, putting it on a wartime footing. That said, I am worried still about the possibility of a Russian intervention in any number of the more vulnerable southeastern provinces. And the ones that are at this point in time most vulnerable seem to be Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkiv. Those are furthest east. Donetsk and Luhansk have the largest number of ethnic Russians. Roughly 40% of the population is ethnic Russian. In Kharkiv, it's roughly 25% ethnic Russian. And it's within these regions in the last few days that we've seen these separatist movements emerge and seize official buildings. And so far there have been some standoffs in a number of these cities. There have also been counterattacks by the security services in Kharkiv and Donetsk, and they've recaptured some of the buildings. But nevertheless, in Luhansk and Donetsk, the separatists, as they're called, still control two, possibly three buildings. And there is the fear that, as you suggested in your question, that they will be fomenting trouble, that they will be asking, as a matter of fact, they've already asked for Russian intervention and for help from Mr. Putin, and that it's not inconceivable that the Russians might decide to intervene militarily in order to save them from the so-called repressive measures of the Ukrainian authorities. At this point, we don't know whether that'll happen, but minimally, what is clearly Mr. Putin's agenda is to cause as much trouble and instability within these regions, the most vulnerable regions, and perhaps within all of Ukraine, to cause as much trouble as possible. Both as a general tactic, the more trouble there is, the more instability there is, the less likely or the more difficult it becomes for the government in Kiev to introduce reforms and to settle into a normal pattern of development. It's been argued as well that Russia wants to disrupt the May 25th presidential elections. If and when they take place, that would obviously give the new government a greater degree of legitimacy in the eyes of the international community as well as the Ukrainian population. So all of these measures, this kind of saber-rattling on the borders, plus these seizures of buildings and declarations of support for Russia, at the very least, they're intended to destabilize things. And in the worst case, they may be intended to lead to Russian seizures of particular provinces along the lines of Crimea.
Well, it would seem, Alexander Model, in terms of the what's happening in Luhansk, where the security buildings have been taken over by these Russian, either political tourists or ethnic Russians. They've apparently holding people captive and they're planting explosives. Now, it seems to me pretty obvious that this whole thing is being orchestrated because we've seen the playbook before in Crimea. But how much can it get out of hand? In other words, if Putin's directing this, which I think he clearly is, can the local actors be restrained or will they go? I mean, I think the flashpoint is when Ukrainians and Russians start shooting each other, isn't it?
I mean, that's clearly the danger. If and when that were to happen, then we'd be then the country could be on the verge of some kind of major destabilization. And clearly that's what Putin would like to happen because, as I said, minimally it causes trouble. Maximally it gives him the opportunity to intervene.
But wait so a minute. Far, wait a minute. Sorry to interrupt you. But do you think he really wants a full-scale bloody war between these two countries?
I'm inclined to think that he doesn't want that. I mean, there are people who believe that. I'm not persuaded. People often argue that Crimea, the seizure of Crimea, sort of sets the pattern for future developments. But Crimea was a special case. Most of the Russian troops that occupied Crimea were already based in Crimea, and 55%+ of the population pretty much supported the invasion. So it was a cakewalk. The Ukrainians gave up without firing a shot, and within a couple of days, most of the peninsula was occupied by Russian military. No lives were lost, except for some Ukrainians and a few Crimean Tatars. So it was easy. It was a grand and glorious little war. Anything in Ukraine, even in the more vulnerable provinces in the southeast, would be significantly more complicated. And, of course, expanding an invasion beyond the southeastern provinces, and there are seven of them, into, you know, the more mainland part of Ukraine, would entail enormous risk. There'd be an insurgency, there'd be opposition, there'd be resistance. This would be a violent resistance. And very quickly, there'd be Russian body bags appearing in Moscow. And whatever hopes for a grand and glorious little war would quickly dissipate if and when this became a major land war entailing thousands of casualties. And one has to assume that Putin, unless, of course, he's completely off his rocker, does appreciate that body bags, large expenditures on a potentially hopeless long-term military campaign will do nothing to increase his popularity within Russia and will certainly do nothing to increase Russia's stability and security. Of course, the other issue that he has to keep in mind is that if there were to be an incursion into Ukraine, even a limited one into one or more of the southeastern provinces, that would almost certainly unleash very severe sanctions on the part of the United States and Europe. Because the next step that has been threatened by both Washington and Brussels are the so-called sectoral sanctions, which would entail imposing controls and of various kinds on Russian finance, banking, energy, and armaments industries. That would really begin to hurt. So Putin has to think twice about any kind of armed incursion. In the meantime, it's just easier to cause trouble, to rattle sabers, to keep the Ukrainians constantly on edge, guessing as to what might happen or what might not happen. So that's clearly in the works. Now, the good news is, so far, now we'll see how things develop tonight, tomorrow, and so on, but the good news is that these Russian or pro-Russian forces that have seized buildings in these three regions, they haven't been met with any kind of popular support. Clearly, they were hoping for some of that. I'm not sure if they were hoping for millions of people to storm into the streets and start waving Russian flags, but they were certainly hoping for 5,000, 10,000, perhaps more, to be showing their support. None of that has materialized, not a single bit. And in contrast, as you mentioned, those separatists that have ensconced themselves in the buildings, especially in Lugansk, they are now essentially resorting to violent terrorist methods. They appear to have mined the building with explosives. There are reports suggesting that they're using women and children in order to barricade, to protect themselves from a possible assault. There's a report, as you said, that there are something like 60 hostages that they've taken. None of that, absolutely none of that, will endear them to the local population. Even people who may have had some sympathy for the cause will now begin to say that these guys are just a bunch of gangsters. This is no way to promote closer relations with Russia or possibly even unification. I mean, violence is something that everyone in these regions, that is to say, every normal average person in these regions, is absolutely terrified of. So this may portend that these seizures, these movements, are fizzling out. As I said, I don't want to be prematurely optimistic because a lot depends on what Putin will do and a lot depends on whether or not there will be additional attempts at subversion and, heaven forbid, that there might be an attempt at a military incursion. That would obviously change things. That would be, radically. But if that doesn't happen, if Putin actually restrains himself, these things, these uprisings, may be on the verge of petering out.
But, of course, talking about occupying these buildings and particularly what's happening in Luhansk, which does seem very dangerous, you are in, of course, two alternative universes. My understanding is that in Ukraine they are getting real news, so the people will know about what's happening there. In Russia, they're getting the completely fictionalized news, which would be saying that these Nazis and fascists and anti-Semites that have taken over Ukraine are persecuting Russians. And, they basically can say what they want because Putin runs a ubiquitous propaganda machine. But, I spoke a week or so ago, it was now, with the independent defense analyst at writes for Novaya Gazeta, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer. He thought that Putin would invade around April the 15th and that he had to get it over with because the army is largely of conscripts and they have to be rotated out and that he simply will not allow this election to take place. So I guess the speculation now is between whether or not he'll go the whole way and risk bloodshed. And you have to admit that he is a former intelligence officer, and what he pulled off in Crimea was, of quite skillful and quite bloodless. So presumably that is his forte. But apparently he's fairly determined not to change these facts on the ground. And at this point, it looks like what he's trying to do is destabilize the place sufficiently to force a referendum, which is what these Russian political tourists are doing.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the destabilization process is obviously in the works, and the Russian forces, I mean, the pro-Russian forces have been insisting on referenda, whereby they would essentially be repeating the kind of ballot that was held in Crimea, which, of course, wasn't democratic and it wasn't much of a referendum. There is also a concern that the timing of any kind of major destabilization might take place in early May. On May 1st, of course, that is May Day, when everybody's parading throughout the former Soviet Union. But more significantly is May 9th, which is Victory Day, the day in which the celebration of the victory over Nazi Germany was held. And over the last 10, 20 years, in Ukraine especially, May 9th has always been a day where the pro-Russian and pro-Ukrainian forces, sometimes extremist, but sometimes just pro-Russian, pro-Ukrainian, have been engaging in clashes, fisticuffs, mutual insults, and things of that sort. So that would be also an ideal opportunity to take advantage of what might happen anyway, some kind of internal disturbances, and then use that to promote even more instability within the country. My understanding is that the Ukrainian authorities, of course, are aware of that, and what they're hoping to do is to make sure that whatever transpires on May 9th will be relatively peaceful, that the pro-Ukrainian forces will pretty much stay at home and keep out of whatever parades take place, and that they'll use this as an opportunity to display their armed forces, whatever their conditions, so as to have a manifestation of strength, but also keep whatever possible provocations to a minimum. But in any case, if Putin wants to engage in some kind of armed incursion, it has to be done, as Mr. Felgengauer suggested, sometime between now and, say, May 9th at the very latest. Because after all, the presidential elections are taking place on May 25th, and you want to create enough trouble so as to disturb them way in advance. If that doesn't happen, then you're dealing with the Western press, you've got observers coming into the country, and things could get potentially messy. So he has a window of opportunity that is, well, in the process of closing. But of course, what's important for him is he also has to have something resembling a pretext. Remember what happened in Crimea. These dubious characters seized control over the government, seized control over the parliament. They declared independence. They asked Russia for support, quote unquote. And then, of course, Putin willingly gave them the support because of a fear of some kind of right-wing fascist elements coming down upon them from Kiev. So he needs those sorts of individuals in place, or at least ideally he would like to have them in place. Otherwise, it just looks like a straightforward invasion. And the problem is that, these separatists who seized the buildings in Luhansk and Donetsk, they seized buildings, but that's all that they've been able to seize. They haven't been able to get anybody on their side. So it basically looks as if they're just a bunch of out-of-control thugs who are resorting to violence to engage in instability. So he needs more, or at least ideally he would like to have more in order to make a more persuasive case for some kind of intervention. The fear is that some of these guys could just decide to stage violent provocations. And that's been a scenario that's occupied many people for the last few weeks. All they need do in the final analysis is kill a couple of innocent ethnic Russians, preferably pensioners, women, something along those lines, and then declare that this is the handiwork of Ukrainian fascists of some kind or other, and then, you know, request Putin for that he'd give brotherly assistance to his repressed population. That's still in the works. I mean, that's still possible. We don't know whether that'll happen, but it's still possible.
And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Alexander Mertl.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we are rejoining the conversation with Alexander Mertl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's also a writer and a painter, and previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. His latest article at the Kiev Post is, Could Russia Occupy Ukraine? So as your article points out, a full occupation of Ukraine, even if he could pull it off with, and certainly it would be amazing to pull it off bloodlessly, and if it goes to a shooting war, it's going to, I think, be extremely nasty, and there'll be a substantial backlash in Russia itself, as you pointed out, with body bags. So that's obviously not the preferred path for Putin, but the short one would be just to go in and protect their brethren who have called for a referendum. So could he carve off enough of these parts of Ukraine, which is apparently where most of the old Soviet industry and the arms industries, etc., are, could he carve off enough of them and have a land corridor down to Crimea, which is pretty much landlocked, isn't it?
That would be, again, there are a number of possible variants. I mean, if the idea is to develop some kind of land corridor, that would mean occupying Donetsk and Zaporizhia and Kherson. So he would need at least three provinces. If he wants to form a corridor from Crimea going westwards to that strip of Moldova called Transnistria, that too would mean occupying three provinces, Kherson, Mykolaiv, and Odessa.
And that would, but wouldn't that deny Ukraine access to the sea?
Well, if all five of those provinces were occupied, yes. If it's only either the three towards the east, Ukraine would still have access via Odessa, Mykolaiv, and Kherson. If it were those three, then it would sort of have access via some of the provinces further east, although that would be problematic because they'd have to go through the so-called Sea of Azov and then cross straits, the so-called Kerch Straits, which connect Crimea to mainland Russia. And, of course, the Russians could conceivably keep ships out. So that would be problematic. But those five provinces happen to be fairly highly populated. One of them, Donetsk, as I said, has a 40% ethnic Russian population. Odessa has 20%. The other three in between are roughly 5 to 10% ethnic Russian, the others, of course, being primarily ethnic Ukrainians. There would be resistance, certainly in three to four of them, medium to high resistance. There would certainly be resistance even in a place like Donetsk, which does have a not insignificant Ukrainian population. And because of the high percentage, because of the high number of people living in these regions, it would take, I did the calculations, roughly, something like 100,000 to 200,000 Russian troops just to occupy them for a longer period of time. That's a lot. that, you know, that's an enormous expenditure of resources and manpower. Obviously, if Putin wants to do it, he could do it. But it would require a very serious mobilization. And at this point in time, estimates of Russians amassed on Ukraine's eastern border are somewhere between 30, 40, 50, 60,000. I mean, I've seen so many different estimates, I'm not quite sure what the real number is, but it's roughly in that range. That would be enough to do, say, Donetsk and maybe Luhansk, you know, separately or possibly together, but it would be very, it might not be enough to do a whole range of these provinces in order to create something like a land corridor to the Crimea.
Well, that's what I was asking about in terms of now that Putin has gotten Crimea, how does he, you know, sustain it? And, of course, the people voted there, even though it was a completely rigged referendum. Apparently, they voted largely along the lines that they would have a better standard of living with under Russian control. But, you know, there's some talk of building a bridge across the Kerch, but that's a huge undertaking, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, they're thinking of building tunnels and bridges across Kerch, presumably as well, if they wanted to become genuinely independent of Ukraine. That also means building a whole series of, electric lines from Russia to Kerch. They'd have to provide Crimea with water, because at this point in time, Crimea gets something like 80 to 90% of its water and electricity from Ukraine. Now, one way of dealing with that issue is to invade Ukraine and to seize those parts that happen to provide water and electricity. Another way of dealing with that would be to build those main lines from mainland Russia into Crimea. Whatever the solution, both of them are extremely expensive. One, of course, is politically risky because it would mean starting a war and essentially inviting further sectoral sanctions from the United States and Western Europe. The other one would entail, you know, billions of dollars of investments in a region that may never fully recover economically. Remember, the Russian population in Crimea is very old, a large number of pensioners. So these are not people who are productive. The Crimean Tatars, who are about 15 to 20% of the population, are highly disgruntled and angry at what's happened to them. And Crimea's primary source of economic well-being and activity happens to be the tourist industry and everything that's associated with the tourist industry. And that, too, is going to take a hit, possibly a permanent hit. How many people want to take vacations in a territory, you know, where tanks are rumbling down the beaches? So he's you know, in annexing Crimea, Putin has certainly provided Russians with this feeling of superiority and this feeling that they're a great power again, although, again, you know, annexing a small peninsula with 2 million isn't exactly a terribly great geopolitical achievement. But that said, the economic costs of this annexation will be very high, and they will have to be paid for by the Russian taxpayer. And I don't think people at this point fully appreciate what that all means for them.
Now, do they appreciate, though, which appears to be the status quo, the fact that the Ukrainians apparently are allowing Russian supplies to go to Crimea through Ukraine? They're not cutting off the electricity. They're not cutting off the water. So that tells you something, doesn't it?
Well, I think, you know, the Ukrainians are doing this with full realization of the fact that if they were to cut off supplies, that might provoke a Russian military attack. And I mean, whether that would be legitimately considered an act of war, I don't know. That is to say, cutting off such supplies. But certainly that would be a provocation, and Kiev is in no position to risk that kind of provocation.
But the Russians are also doubling the price of gas, aren't they?
Right. And now, Kiev has said, I mean, I've heard, you know, ministers speak to the effect that they will be supplying water at market rates and electricity at market rates. Now, whether they've actually done that or are they simply planning to do this, I don't know at this point in time. But they have said that, you know, this, you know, we're not going to do this for free anymore. You're going to have to buy this at whatever the market rates happen to be. And that seems like an equitable solution. And they'll have to work out some kind of deal. By the same token, there is talk within Kiev of charging Russia more for the transit of gas by means of the Ukrainian pipelines. Russia has set a very high price for gas, and Ukraine is now perfectly entitled to set correspondingly higher prices for the transit of gas to Western Europe. So there is some way in which Ukraine can respond to these unilateral Russian measures to squeeze it in terms of energy. Of course, the ultimate solution is for Ukraine to develop its own energy sources, to develop alternative energy sources, and, of course, to cut back on its energy use. As you may know, Ukraine per capita utilizes roughly four times as much energy as Europe and roughly twice as much as the United States. So they could certainly save on energy simply by introducing certain basic kinds of energy conservation methods.
So what you're telling us, though, in general, is that Ukraine doesn't want to do anything that's provocative in terms of its counter-leverage against Russia, having seized its territory of Crimea. They nevertheless want to continue supplying food and electricity and access to this landlocked peninsula. And likewise, Russia is upping the ante by doubling the price of gas. But then you mentioned that Ukraine still has some leverage there because it's the transit of gas to the European markets for the Russians. So they can demand more. So I take it that's something of a kind of a standoff. But I guess at the end of the day, because we're speculating here, Alexander Model, you have to get back to the mind of Putin, and then that's not an easy thing to divine. But it does seem that he has a sense of a new world order or even a new Byzantium. I mean, he's really seems to be on a roll here, and he's become incredibly popular for what he's done so far. And this may be feeding his sense of delusion that the German Prime Minister alluded to. So are you convinced that he does have this idea of a new world order, of regaining some of the lost territory of the Soviet Union?
I think he has a vision. I think he would like to reestablish Russia as a great power in the international arena. That is to say, equal to the United States and other countries, perhaps like China. I'm absolutely certain he wants to reestablish some form of Russian hegemony and control over the former Soviet Union. I'm not sure that this is the only consideration that he has in mind when he makes decisions. If it were the only consideration, then he should have been invading Ukraine 4 weeks ago, right after the incursion into Crimea. But he's obviously calculating odds. He's obviously looking for better and worse or worse opportunities. He wants to shift the balance of forces in as much in his favor as he possibly can. And he may have been deterred, at least to some degree, by the Western response, by the unanimous Western condemnation. That suggests to me that...
By the way, and the UN as well. It wasn't
and
just...
the UN, exactly. UN, NATO, I mean, every single international institution has condemned the annexation of Crimea. So that suggests to me that there are at least two or three factors at work in his mind. One is this vision thing, to quote George Bush, this notion of reestablishing a great Russia, but at the same time, a certain sense or a calculation of the odds in any particular moment. Mm-hmm. In other words, he doesn't seem to be completely reckless. He's not simply driven by the ideology. He does seem to understand that there are better and worse moments to do things.
Well,
that's the case, that leads me to be somewhat hopeful, again, not too hopeful, but somewhat hopeful that Western sanctions can make a difference, and most important, that Ukraine itself can deter him. What Ukraine has done over the last 4 or 5 weeks, it's beefed up its military. It's still not what it should be, but they're beefing it up. They're beefing up their defenses. They're beefing up their control of the borders. And if they get through this current crisis, they may also be in the position to have a handle on some of the internal unrest. So once again, we come back to that window of opportunity for Putin. The longer he waits with any potential territorial incursion, the worse it gets for him, the more complicated, the costlier, the more risky it becomes.
Sure. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Alexander Model. I thank you for your time. And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Model, a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, and he's a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with an American who's moved with his family to Rwanda, where they have a successful restaurant, and we'll be talking to him about the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Josh Ruxin, who is director of the Health Builders in Rwanda. Dr. Ruxin has extensive experience operating at the intersection of public health, business, and international development. In 1996, he joined Monitor Group, and during his years at the Monitor Group, Dr. Ruxin led projects in several developing countries and was an advisor to government and private sector leaders on business strategy and economic development. He's the author of A Thousand Hills to Heaven, Love, Hope, and a Restaurant in Rwanda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Ruxin.
Thank you so much.
And you're on your way back to Kigali, and on Monday, Rwanda launched a week of official mourning to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the massacres, which left more than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis and moderate Hutus, dead at the hands of Hutu extremists and a number of world leaders. Tony Blair, Thabo Mbeki from South Africa, have come to the official ceremony. The French, of course, are conspicuously absent, having been told not to show up. At least the French ambassador was told not to show up. Just give me a sense about what's happening there on the ground. Is this a country that is healing?
Oh, absolutely. So I've actually lived in Rwanda with my family for nearly a decade, and we've had the unique opportunity to watch as this country, who most prognosticators thought was going to fail, actually succeed. And although this, of course, does mark an incredibly sad time 20 years after the horrendous genocide, on the other hand, it's also a time of great optimism because 20 years out, the country's economic growth is fantastic. Health outcomes are dramatically improved. The entire country actually looks different than it did 20 years ago. There's roads going everywhere, much improved access to electricity, water. It's really one of the very few places in sub-Saharan Africa that is getting the basics right for all people.
And the health ministry apparently have done a survey in Rwanda saying that one in three children still have post-traumatic stress disorder from the extraordinary violence, where quite often within families, Hutus murdered Tutsis, even if they were married. I imagine the psychological scars are so profound that it's not surprising. But what's your sense of, if on the surface everything is working economically, etc., what about inside the hearts and minds of the people?
Well, I think 10 years ago, the country looked quite a bit different, and the psychological scars were more visible on people's faces and in their demeanor. I think today, with nearly half the population having been born after the genocide, and certainly the vast majority having no recollection of the genocide, it really is a country on the move where they're not looking back, they're looking forward. Now, of course, back in the countryside and areas where people suffer terribly from the genocide and yet have not reaped terrific opportunities, there's still a lot of time to focus on the past. But I would say that in terms of PTSD, it's no national epidemic, and it's something that certainly is very rarely seen.
Yeah, in fact, let me just requote that the health ministry said that close to one-third of adult Rwandans still exhibit symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a 2011 report from the health ministry. So in terms of the international gathering there, of course, the United States is represented by UN Ambassador Samantha Power, who won a Pulitzer Prize for her book about the U.S. failures to respond to genocides in Rwanda and in the former Yugoslavia. I mentioned Tony Blair and Thabo Mbeki. Also, the head of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, basically said that the UN feels the deep remorse for having failed to stop the genocide. One of the things that is so extraordinary is that how, looking back, and even at the time, I think it was pretty clear that so few peacekeepers could have kept the peace. What's your sense of the collective guilt of the West in that regard?
Well, I've actually had the opportunity living in Rwanda to talk to a number of military advisors and others who have sort of deconstructed the genocide. And the pervasive view is that, first of all, the forces on the ground could have done much more and could have saved a lot more people. And with relatively light increases in support, perhaps two-thirds or greater portion of the genocide and the genocide victims could have been avoided. So it really is, unfortunately, a stain on the West that this was not stopped. When my wife and I moved to Rwanda nearly a decade ago, one of the things that she found were genocide survivors without jobs. And one of the reasons she decided to develop a restaurant and hospitality training center was to create jobs for those very same victims. And in fact, Samantha Power was in Heaven Restaurant last night with a huge delegation. And I think it was quite a somber, but again, optimistic affair in the sense that everyone gets to see how far Rwanda has come in spite of the lack of support 20 years ago.
So going back to the killings that were triggered on April the 7th in 1994, when a plane carrying the president of Rwanda and Burundi's Hutu president as well was shot down near Kigali Airport. And that triggered this extraordinary bloodletting, where the media radio programs, of course, urged Hutus to kill Tutsis, calling them cockroaches. Neighbors attack neighbors, teachers kill students. And as mentioned about, intermarriage between the two groups, husbands handed over wives to be killed, etc. So it was a horrendous bloodletting. But has anybody ever gotten to the bottom of what triggered it? And I know that, of course, Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, blames the French in many ways for somehow being behind the chicanery that led to the shoot down of the plane. Conversely, a French judge has blamed Paul Kagame for shooting down the plane. So what do we know about what triggered that event?
Well, I don't think that we know enough to actually conclusively state who shot down the plane. You just elucidated what the two sides are. I think what we do know for sure is that from 1959 to 1994, with Belgian and French support, Hutu power led pogroms, massacred thousands and thousands of people, and launched a propaganda campaign that over the course of many decades was the real groundwork for the genocide. And this is part of the story that is often missing, is that people think that, oh, the genocide happened because the plane went down and it occurred over 100 days, when in fact there had been a civil war that was already occurring between 1990 and 1994, and the genocide was really the culmination.
So were there colonial fingerprints on that? Were the French supporting one tribe, the Hutu, and were the British supporting the other, the Tutsi? I mean, those were common colonial games. In many ways, we're enduring the legacy of the French colonial experiment in Syria, where they empowered the minority Alawite community, gave them the power to hold down the majority. So was there colonial chicanery in this tribal politics?
Absolutely, because the tribes as they stand did not really exist until colonization. And it was the colonists who basically determined who was Tutsi and who was Hutu in the first place, very frequently by counting the number of cows that someone had. And then that really essentially empowered the group that was identified as Tutsis until 1959. Then in 1959, with independence, the tables were turned and Hutu power rose up and really made Tutsis second-class citizens in their own country. And throughout that entire period, 1959 to 1994, there was extensive support, including military support, from European powers.
And what's explained the ability of the Tutsis to come back with Kagame and recapture the country after so many, 800,000 of their brethren had been massacred? Where did Kagame get his forces from? And the impression one gets is that so many people were killed. So where was he able to find this Tutsi army to come back and retake the country?
It's actually a remarkable story that's not told enough, but actually is studied at West Point, which is that Paul Kagame and his best friend, Fred Guigema, starting in the 1980s, began building a shadow army called the Rwanda Patriotic Army within the Ugandan military. And in 1990, when this was nearly discovered, and by that time they had several thousand troops, they launched an attack on Rwanda to liberate Rwanda. And that was the beginning of a civil war. Eventually they had fought Hutu power to a standstill, and when Hutu power saw that it was losing, that was going to have to power share, that was when the genocide happened.
So after the, in July the 4th is when the RPF under Kagame controlled Kigali, but then that led to a counter-massacre, didn't it? And then the Hutus are then driven into the Congo, which has been destabilized ever since.
Well, it's certainly true that the Rwandan military, or I should say the RPF, RPA forces, chased the Genocidaire into Congo. And indeed, that is really one of the leading causes of the horrors that have occurred in Congo. I would suggest that there are a lot of other causes as well, and there was certainly terrible instability in eastern Congo before 1994, but it was certainly wildly exacerbated by this drive of the Genocidaire into eastern Congo, and it continues to be a melting pot of all sorts of militia groups, including those few Genocidaire who still reside in eastern Congo.
So there has been a genocide fugitive tracking unit that have issued a number of arrest warrants of these genocidaires living in Europe and Canada and the United States. Apparently the most prominent one, or the highest level, or I guess the most wanted, is apparently living in Kenya under protection of Kenya's leaders, and that is the businessman who was supposedly, the Hutu businessman who allegedly bankrolled the genocide, Felicien Kabuga. Do you know anything about him?
No, I don't, actually. I try to focus much more on the present and the future of Rwanda than on the past, and don't get overly caught up in the tracking of these very terrible figures. But I can say that the Rwandan government does rightly place tremendous resources on forcing the international community to do finally what's right all these years later.
Well, they've had for 2 million people have gone through what do they call gachachas. So, go ahead. Explain what they are about.
Well, the gachacha process was basically resurrecting an ancient court process, a community court process, in fact, and it enabled an enormous number of people to be processed after the genocide. And communities basically were asked to hear out the perpetrators. And very, very horrible stories, as you can imagine, were heard en masse on a weekly basis in Rwanda for several years. And eventually, those who confessed were either given time in prison and then later released or given prison time. And there are some who still serve prison time, but the vast majority have been released. While it's a much criticized process, the view on the ground is I don't think anyone could have come up with anything better, you know, given the immensity of the crimes and the overall number of people who are actually involved. I actually have friends who served in the gachacha process, and they had extraordinary experiences. And feel that overall it was an extremely fair and just process.
So, Josh Ruxin, you mentioned I know you're at the airport about to go to Kigali, and your wife is there, and she owns a restaurant at which Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, who's representing the U.S. in these ceremonies that go on for a week, starting on Monday in Rwanda. To officially mourn and commemorate the 20th anniversary of these massacres. Tell me about the restaurant. Tell me about what it's like doing business there and in general, what you're trying to do in terms of, I take it you're trying to encourage local entrepreneurs. Is that what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. And just to take a step back, and this is all documented in a book that I recently published called A Thousand Hills to Heaven. And it's really a book about my wife and our experiences raising a family and starting this restaurant in Rwanda and also the public health work that I've done. Rwanda is very much a place that's open for business. It's highly transparent. We've never faced corruption in setting up a business. Anyone can set up a business within about 24 hours in Rwanda. And I think the great challenges are that it's a new country. Such a high percentage of the population was born just in the last 20 years, and they aren't necessarily exposed to international service standards. So we go to great lengths to invest in our employees, to invest in our team, so that they can deliver a first-rate experience, not just by Rwandan standards, but by any.
So what are these reports then we hear, and particularly in terms of those that the French, for example, who are outraged at the remarks by Paul Kagame for accusing them and the Belgians for being complicit in the massacre. And there is evidence that Tutsis who'd escaped to safe areas under the French military control were massacred. So there's clearly still some reckoning to be done there. But Kagame himself has something of a reputation of being authoritarian. So give me a sense of if you have a country there where there isn't any corruption, which is very unusual in Africa, what's the disconnect then between his authoritarianism and lack of corruption?
Oftentimes I will turn to wiser souls like our staff at Heaven. There's a guy named John who's our head of service. And when I ask him, you know, whether he feels as though his liberties are impaired by authoritarianism, he just laughs and says, you know, most Rwandans feel freer than they ever have in the course of their lives or their parents' or grandparents' lives, free to set up business, free to go to school, free to walk the streets at night without living in fear, free to do whatever they want. And so I think that an insider's view of Rwanda looks dramatically different from the character by the outside.
Well, just in closing then, Josh Ruxin, given that there's so much guilt around the world, that which the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, expressed and was quite remorseful. Samantha Power, of course, as we mentioned, wrote a book about the US's failure. Bill Clinton, apparently, and Al Gore both feel a residual guilt. And Susan Rice, who's the head of the National Security Council, who was on the Africa desk at the State Department at the time, she also feels remorse and has spoken about it. So how is this remorse translated then into anything real on the ground? Because, you know, we've mentioned the ongoing horrors in the Congo, where about 8 million people have died and nobody seems to give a damn. Yet everybody, quite justifiably, are appalled about what's happening in Syria. But there is genuinely a feeling here of a double standard, that Africans can die in large numbers anonymously, and if a few Europeans and others die, we seem to be much more concerned.
You know, there's an incredible amount of hand-wringing and remorse that's displayed, but I don't see it translating into any outsized levels of aid or investment. And you know, the Rwandans are very clear about how they feel about it, which is, you abandoned us then, but today we have great opportunity. And if you want to do something for us, don't give us just traditional aid. Bring business. Come and visit as a tourist. Spend money here. Help us improve our national treasures. Help us improve our overall country, our education, our infrastructure. You know, help us with the things that are going to be sustained in the long run. I mean, one thing that the government of Rwanda has gone on the record many times as saying is that they don't want to be a donor recipient nation 15, 20 years from now. That's incredible ambition. And you can't even find far wealthier nations in Africa who would ever make a statement. And I think this comes out of the genocide. When you see that relying on the outside doesn't necessarily get you anywhere, you change tactics and you change strategy and you improve and realize that the best way to get a hand up is to have private investment and to create a level playing field where investors do want to put their dollars. And we're seeing this in Rwanda. They've actually floated a couple of bonds very successfully, an extraordinary achievement for a little landlocked country. I think that Rwanda is really on the right track. Going back to your comment about Congo, I also believe that a good, strong Rwanda is probably good for the region. It does provide general geopolitical stability. And I think that the more that Rwanda and Eastern Congo can engage, the better. I mean, a stable Eastern Congo is actually very good for the Rwandan economy. So I think everybody has got a shared view of that. The problem is that there is absolutely no government structure per se in Eastern Congo. So you just cross the border into Rwanda, you see the streets are clean, you see that there isn't the chaos, you see that the health system is actually functioning. There's a national health insurance policy and program that covers over 90% of the population. It's stunning the difference that a strong government that actually cares about its people can make in the lives of its citizens. And that's why I'm living in Rwanda, and that's why I'm flying back home there.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Josh Roxon.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.